Jacob Butler from the Outreach Office at the Cambridge University's Cavendish Laboratory. Hopefully you're well aware of what physics is at work is now. If you haven't had a chance to see our videos, we've got some wonderful ones that give you a great overview of all the sorts of interesting things you can do with a physics degree, all sorts of jobs you can work in and research you can end up doing. Today, I'm talking to the High Energy Physics Research Group. They're one of our research groups from here at Cavendish, but they don't just work here, they work all over the world. In fact, we have an international connection here calling in from Switzerland over at CERN. And rather than you listening to me talk, I shall pass over to them to give you a bit of an introduction of who they are. So if we could start with Harry, please. You could introduce yourself for us.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Harry Cliff. I'm a postdoctoral researcher on LHCb, which is one of the four detectors at the LHC. We'll talk probably about a bit later on.
Excellent. And Steve, next.
Hi, so I'm Steve Wilson. I'm also a researcher at the Cavendish Lab working on LHCb. I also have an interest in muon scattering tomography, which you may have seen on the video.
Excellent, thank you. And Ben?
Hi, everyone. I'm Ben Hodkinson. I've just finished my first year as a PhD student in the group. And rather than LHCb, I work on one of the other experiments at the LHC called ATLAS. And my work involves searching for new particles in supersymmetry.
Excellent, thank you. And Michele, isn't it?
Yes, hello. I'm a PhD student at Cambridge, working at LHCb, but actually we are based in Geneva at CERN. I'm working on one of the experiment's detectors, which is called RIDGE, and we could maybe go into more detail later on that.
And who's that next to you?
Next to me, Floris. Sorry.
Yeah, my name is Floris. I'm a postdoctoral researcher, and I finished my PhD in Cambridge a year ago on the LHCb RIDGE experiment as well, like Michael, and also on muon scattering tomography.
Lovely, thank you. And Sarah?
This time I'm muted. Hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Williams. I'm a postdoctoral researcher on the ATLAS experiment, which Ben has already mentioned. So this is another of the detectors around the LHC ring.
Lovely. And to finish off, Tina.
Hi, I'm Tina Potter. I'm a lecturer here at Cambridge where I teach and do research. My research is my most fun part. So I work on the ATLAS experiments. Ben is one of my students here. And we're looking for signs of new physics in our collisions and, you know, maybe something beyond what we expect from the standard model, maybe something that could explain the dark matter in our universe.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Now then, to get us started. Now, Harry mentions that in the video that the standard model is the best scientific theory that scientists have come up with. Now, what makes it the best if we already know that it's incomplete? I mean, surely that means there's problems with it, that perhaps other theories might be better.
Maybe Harry, you could take this.
Yeah, I can take that. It is an amazingly successful theory. So there are definitely things it doesn't explain, but it does explain a hell of a lot. So it basically describes all the particles that we know about in the universe that make up the ordinary matter that we're made of, that the Earth is made of, that the stars are made of. And it describes three of the four forces that we know about. So there's the electromagnetic force that holds electrons around the nucleus of an atom, and then the nuclear forces, the strong and the weak nuclear force. And it's really dazzlingly successful in describing almost every experiment we've ever done. So to give you a sense, the electron, the first fundamental particle to be discovered, the thing that goes around the edge of an atom, the electron has an electric charge, but it also has a magnetic field. So it behaves like a little bar magnet. And you can use the equations of the standard model to calculate how strong that little magnet should be. And you get a number that goes to 10 significant figures. And when you do an experiment, a very clever experiment, and measure that quantity, you find that it agrees with your theory to 10 decimal places. So it's like one part in 10 billion agreement. That's the best scientific prediction and agreement with experiment anywhere in science in any area. So this theory is definitely right in some sense, but it's not that it's an incorrect theory, it's that it's an incomplete theory. And we know that, for example, that 95% of the energy matter content of the universe cannot be described by the standard model. So these are these mysterious things called dark matter and dark energy, which is why we think there must be something else that we've missed that we're looking for, that particularly people that we're looking for at LHCB indirectly, and that Tina and Sarah and the students are also looking for at Atlas. So it's a great theory. It works brilliantly. It's the best scientific theory that exists, more or less. But we also know it cannot be the end of the story, and there must be more to be added to that picture.
Excellent, which I assume is why you as a researcher exist. You know, if this was all done and all completed, there wouldn't be much point in you turning up to work every day, would there?
Yeah, it'd be a bit boring.
Indeed. Now, just for a little bit of clarification, if you don't mind. So we hear about dark matter and dark energy a lot. So are any of you able to sort of explain that to some students that might not be fully aware exactly what these things are describing? You know, what is dark matter? Is it literally just stuff that's dark? Is there, you know, what is it to physicists? I think Tina wanted to comment on that.
Okay, so there is matter in our universe that we can't explain. So when we look at galaxies and how fast they're moving, they're rotating much, much faster than we can explain, given the mass of the stars and the gas that we can see. So this matter that's contained in galaxies, actually the bulk of the matter, we call it dark matter because we can't see it with visible light or any of the other forces. It appears to be something completely new, completely different, not the particles that make up stars and gases and things like that. So this is what we call dark matter, and we're trying to figure out what that is. And that makes up about 27% of our universe. The matter that we know about, like that makes up stars and gases and planets and you and me and stuff, is only about 4.5% of the universe. I hope I'm getting my numbers right here. And then a huge sort of 70% of our universe is something called dark energy, which is responsible for the universe continuing to accelerate as it expands and not collapsing back in on itself with gravity. And that's even more mysterious, and I can't even begin to explain what that is.
Yeah, oh, thank you. It's fascinating stuff. And it sounds a lot like, you know, it's something that we might traditionally think would be the realm of astronomers. You know, astrophysicists would be looking at it because we're looking at space. But yeah, it's interesting to hear that actually it's the fundamental particles, isn't it, this, that we're interested in, understanding exactly what those are.
Yeah, the marrying up of the very small scale versus the very large scale is amazing.
Indeed. And uniquely physics, I think, as well, just to give us a bit of a plug. Right then, you mentioned as well in the video that particle physics has been done for about 100 years. I was wondering just how the sort of experiments that scientists have done have changed over that time. You know, is there much that's in common? Is there much that's different? I think Steve's wanting to answer that one.
Yeah, I thought it would be appropriate because I'm probably the oldest one here. So for me, not so much history as for the rest of you, but okay. So, I mean, what's interesting, I think, to note about particle physics is not just the things that have changed experimentally, but the things which are actually the same. You know, for 100 years now, we've basically been doing particle physics by trying to smash the smallest objects that we can detect, smash them apart to see what's inside them, essentially. And we do that by accelerating particles and colliding them with other particles and seeing what comes out and detecting the stuff that comes out. So that's basically what we've been doing for 100 years. But what's changed a lot actually is the scale of the experiments, not just in terms of the size, the physical size of the experiment, which back in those days would fit easily on a tabletop, but also the number of people involved. Back 100 years ago, it was rare for more than one or two or three people working on an experiment at the same time, whereas now in our experiments, we have thousands of physicists all working on the same apparatus. And of course, actually, the physical size of the apparatus is enormous, right? It's 27 kilometers circumference, the LHC accelerator. And the detectors are the size of a cathedral buried underground. So I think there are very big differences, but there are similar. It's always important to remember that there are also similarities, and the basic underlying principle is the same. It's looking with ever increasing energy, and by increasing the energy, you can look at smaller and smaller things.
Okay, that's fascinating. Thanks. And talking about those collisions, I'd heard it said that the sort of temperatures and pressures that you create during those collisions had only existed in the Big Bang. So you're creating things.
Yes,
is that true, or is that sort of a bit of an exaggeration?
No, that's correct. Essentially, what was the reason we talk in those terms is that back in the early days of the Big Bang, All of these exotic particles which we produce now in the Large Hadron Collider were being produced actually at the very early stages of the universe. And these are all very exotic particles, which need a lot of, and they tend to be heavy particles, so they need a lot of energy to be produced. And that equates to having a higher temperature environment, right? A hotter environment has, there's more energy there. So you can produce heavier objects. And these particles are exotic and they're unstable and they decay very quickly. So what we do now in our accelerators essentially is we recreate the same conditions of a very, very high, if you like, energy density in a very, it's a lot of energy in a very, very small volume, essentially in the size of, you can imagine it being in the size of the protons that were colliding together. So all of the energy of collision is going into a very small volume. And that energy density there is, it allows all these new particles to be produced in our experiments. So in that sense, this process is the same as happening at the early part of the universe in the first seconds.
Excellent, thank you very much for that. Another thing you mentioned in the video a lot is sort of indirect measurement. So rather than measuring something directly, you see how a particle is affected by interacting with that thing and then measure the properties of that particle, or you sort of see what the effects of that thing are on the particles that you measure. Now, is this something that's a better technique than just doing the sort of direct measurements that students might be familiar with from school, where you can see stuff, or is it because it's a necessary limit of the apparatus we've got? So the apparatus is such that you can only record these things indirectly. You can't interact directly with the sorts of particles and things you might be interested in.
Does anyone want to take that, Sarah or Tina or Ben?
I can do if you like. So, I mean, I think one of the problems with trying to do direct measurements is it's already been mentioned that in order to make a direct measurement of a new particle, you need to have enough energy to produce it. So I guess some of you might, in your readings about popular science, come across Einstein's famous E=mc² equation. So we're limited in the energy of our collisions by the mass of the particles we can produce. However, even if we couldn't necessarily produce them directly, there's a chance that because the quantum world works very mysteriously, even if we can't directly produce them, these new potentially very heavy particles could actually alter some of the processes that we're looking at. And so by trying to measure these processes, we could see indirect signs. I kind of sometimes compare this to if you think there was something hiding under your bed, maybe coming out at night and stealing your food, then if you had a good enough telescope, then maybe you could actually one night catch it directly, but you could over time maybe prove that it's definitely there by seeing the effects. So it's kind of two very complementary ways we can try and test it. And I think the main thing is these indirect measurements could uncover signs of particles we couldn't directly see at the LHC, but could then go on and search for later on, which could be really exciting. So things to look forward to.
Indeed. And just out of curiosity, what sort of things are we excited about in high energy physics at the moment? What's the fringes that are exciting you as, I mean, maybe our PhD students wanted to comment as they're sort of doing more of the more specific work at the moment. So is there anything that's exciting at the moment in high energy physics?
Ben, you could tell us what you're looking for.
Yeah, sure. So my research involves this theory called supersymmetry, which basically predicts an extra new particle for every particle we already know about in the standard model. So there's loads of stuff to look for in the data that gets produced at the LHC, and it could potentially solve some of the mysteries that we've already talked about, like Tina mentioned, dark matter. That could have a potential explanation if supersymmetry was to be the correct theory of the universe, because one of the particles in supersymmetry actually could be a dark matter particle. That's what I'm working on. And I think that's really exciting. I don't know if anyone else has other things they want to share.
Harry has just put his hand up. So
I'll just plug something that's going on at LHCB at the moment. So So far, the LHC's not seen any. Alex and CMS discovered the Higgs boson, which was the sort of the main achievement of the LHC of the last 10 years. But so far, we haven't seen any signs of new particles. But at LHCb, these indirect sorts of measurements that Sarah was talking about, we measure these particles called beauty quarks, which are sort of exotic versions of the quarks that make up the nucleus of an atom. And these particles are very sensitive to the existence of much, much heavier particles that you might not be able to detect directly. So we've been making very precise measurements of these particles, particularly in the ways these particles decay. And what's interesting is there are several measurements now where the results of those measurements don't quite agree with the standard model prediction. And I said at the beginning that standard models predicted some quantities fantastically precisely. So this is where you're getting effects that are like 25% different from the standard model, which is quite intriguing. So we don't know yet whether this is some statistical fluke or whether we've messed up something in our analysis or in the experiment, but there are a lot, there's several of these measurements now that all seem to form a coherent picture. So it's a bit like in Sarah's analogy that you've, you know, found some footprints leading out from under your bed, but you know, you don't know whether it was the next door neighbor's cat or whether it was, you know, living under your bed yet. So it's that generated a lot of excitement in physics in general. And I think it's fair to say that's probably where the most promising signs of new physics are at the moment, although we don't know which way it's going to go, whether these things will fade away as we take more data and record and improve our measurements, or whether they're going to get bigger and then eventually we'll have it real, you know, smoking gun evidence there's something new out there, which would be really exciting.
Excellent. It's interesting as well to hear you talk about being excited about finding things that were sort of went wrong with your experiment or weren't expected. I mean, I think, you know, most of our audience will be used to sort of high school experiments where you're expecting to get a result. If you don't get that, something's gone wrong. I mean, how do you differentiate between that? Or do you just not know until you do more experiments into it? Sarah's put her hand up for that.
I guess it's probably worth saying that actually, you know, when you're starting to learn about how to do experiments, often what you're doing is testing things that, are, you know, we understand very well to develop the skills. But actually, you know, most of science is defined by seeing effects that aren't explained by your current model, and by kind of pushing your understanding to the frontiers, then eventually what happens is your current understanding might break down and you'll go further. I think the exciting thing is by being able to build kind of more powerful machines, go to very high energies. So that means you're looking at very small length scales, turning back time closer and closer towards the conditions of the Big Bang. What we're really hoping for is that actually what we're going to see is the point at which our current theory breaks, and then we might come across something new. And that's not to say we were wrong all along. It's just you say, well, actually, this model works very well until we start considering these conditions, and then we have to adapt it. But, you know, remember that just over 100 years ago, people thought that atoms were the smallest possible thing. And, you know, a lot of physics works by thinking that there's nothing smaller than an atom, which actually means indivisible. And then, you know, you push things a bit further and realize that that's not quite the case.
Hmm. Indeed, it's fascinating to see these sort of steps, isn't it, going from the fundamentals and building it up, and how we go from these learning the basics of science at school and then applying it to all sorts of interesting things later on. Now then, Steve mentioned in his section of the video that you can use cosmic rays to measure the structural integrity of bridges. And that was something that was completely new to me. I thought it was fantastic to think of this idea of what we'd consider to be sort of very high level, quite theoretical physics, tying directly into some practical application. I mean, are there any other practical applications of the sort of work that's being done by high-energy physicists at the moment? Or do those things tend to come many years later when we understand them a lot more? I've noticed Ben's got his hand up for that one, so if you want to take that.
Yeah, there's one I wanted to mention to do with a medical application of some of the things that goes on in particle physics experiments. So some of you who do GCSE physics might have heard of something called radiation therapy, where X-rays are fired at cancer cells. And there's a very similar cancer therapy, which is currently being used at the moment, called proton therapy. And it's a similar idea where instead of X-rays, they fire protons at cancer cells in order to kill them. Because protons, they can be kind of fired a bit more precisely than X-rays. But in order to do this, they have to accelerate the protons to really high speeds. And well, that's exactly what they do at experiments like the LHC. So the accelerator technology that's been developed in the 20th century in order to accelerate protons can be directly applied in these sorts of medical applications to fight cancer and potentially save lives. So I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, maybe a contribution from CERN, the CERN people as well?
Yeah, so the use of these cosmic rays is indeed very, very fascinating, because these come from primary protons that hit our atmosphere very high up, and these create a shower of particles, and there are these muons, which are like heavy electrons, which reach the Earth's surface, and they rain down on Michele, on me, and on you, everywhere. And the fact that they are so widely spread makes muon scattering tomography actually highly applicable, because you don't need to bring a source of particles to the objects that you want to measure. You just need to bring the detectors. And for example, to image in the past, there have been images of the inside of volcanoes, of the insides of pyramids. We can even look at shadow from the moon. And all these exciting things are just by bringing detectors and looking at the absorption of these cosmic ray muons. Comparing the spectrum that you measure below an object to the spectrum that you would expect if there was no object. And then there's a second method to use these muons, which is the apparatus that Steve Wooten showed in the laboratory. And that's to look at the way these muons scatter from objects. So this amount of scattering is proportional to both the density, but also to the square of the atomic number of the object that you're looking at. So you can tell apart, for example, a little bit of uranium, which has a very large atomic number, from iron, say. And this can be used to look at the inside of nuclear waste drums, where you have a lot of heavy material, you have everything is poured in concrete, etc. So if you just look at the absorption, most things would get absorbed. But by looking at the amount of scattering of the particles that can go through, you can tell apart the uranium from the concrete, for example.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Fascinating to hear as well that it's sort of all end to the technology, whether it's the accelerated technology or the detectors, you know. The idea that going to the hospital, you might end up sat next to what's essentially a piece of physics experimental apparatus. It's amazing to hear. Now then, one thing that's mentioned in the video is a grand theory of everything. Now, what does that mean to you as a sort of working physicist? Is it something that's ever likely to really happen? And what would it look like if we did have it? Would it be something we could easily write down and people on the street could understand? Or would it be strings upon strings of equations? Has anyone got any thoughts on that?
I can maybe do the easy bit in that. So one of the things, so we were talking about history earlier in particle physics, and one of the things that has happened over the years is that the forces which we formerly thought were different forces have already been unified. So for example, the electric and magnetic forces, which you may think of as completely separate forces, which have different effects on different sorts of objects. In fact, Maxwell wrote down a theory which unified those two forces into a single theory, a very successful theory. And since then, actually, the additional forces have been unified with the electromagnetic force. The weak nuclear force has also been unified together. So with the same description, the same theoretical model, you can then describe all three forces. So when we talk about a grand unified theory, what we're talking about is making the same, describing using the same theoretical model, all of the known forces. So that includes the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and the really, really difficult one, gravity. And the challenge is, I mean, it's a really big challenge. We've gone a lot of the way already, so it's a big success, but we're not at the stage where we're ready to, or where we have a theory which combines everything together. And that's partly because the scale of these, the strengths of these forces is so radically different, and it's very hard to write down a theory which at the same time describes the gravitational force, which is 40 orders of magnitude weaker than than the other forces. It's just very difficult to do. But people have some ideas, and there are some pointers in which direction to go. I don't know whether anybody else has any insights into the current state of the
Harry's just put his hand up, so we'll see what he's got to add. Oh, you're still muted at the moment, Harry.
Sorry. Just I was going to say, as experimental physicists, I think the problem with these ideas is that they tend to make these grand unified theories or theories of everything. They make statements, as Steve said, about energy scales that are way, way, way beyond what we can access at something like the LHC. So say a theory that unifies the strong force with the electroweak force, so the unified force in the standard model, that would require an energy about a trillion times larger than what the Large Hadron Collider could produce. So it's very difficult, therefore, to test these ideas. One way that they have in the past tried to test these ideas is one consequence of grand unified theories is that protons, which are make up the nucleus of atoms, become unstable and they can decay into other particles. Now, we know this can't happen very often, because if it did, then all the protons of the universe would have decayed and we wouldn't be any matter and we wouldn't exist. So it must happen very, very rarely. But if you get a big, big tank of water, which has got, you know, huge numbers of protons in it, you surround it with detectors and you wait, then if a proton decay, you know, every so often, if one or two out of the trillions and trillions of protons in that tank decays, you can then see that happening. And experiments were done in the 80s and actually still going on now, where you try to see how often this happens. And so far, there's no sign of protons decaying. And that seems to suggest that at least the versions of these unified theories that proposed in the 1980s are wrong. And if there are versions of unified theories, they must be more elaborate or baroque in some way. So there's actually an experiment in Japan being planned called Hyper Kamiokande, which is one of these big water tanks underground. And it's a bigger version of an experiment that was done in the 80s and then in the 90s as well, where they started off looking for proton decay and they haven't seen it. But there's a chance with this even bigger tank of water that they might see something. But that's the real problem. And, you know, a lot of theorists spend a lot of time thinking about these ideas, but the real difficult thing is how you connect them with some experiment that we can actually do on Earth, which makes them sometimes sort of, as experimental physicists, not that interesting, I guess.
Mm. So it's sort of pie in the sky ideas, but it's actually tying them into things that we can measure and we can do with our current technology, I suppose. That's that issue. Now then, the sort of audience we're looking at today will be sort of 14 to 16 years old. If they're interested in physics and they want to end up doing things similar to you, they'll be looking at it in sort of 5 to 10 years' time. So what do you think high energy physics will be like in that sort of time period? I mean, do you think that we'll still be dealing with accelerators like CERN? You know, I think CERN, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN will still be being used? Or are we looking at sort of moving to new models and new ways of doing things? I noticed, well, Sarah hasn't spoken much, and she's told me she can't put her digital hand up. So I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, Sarah?
I can do. Tina's also got her hand up, and I've worked out the hand raising, but I can carry on. So actually, I mean, the LHC is going to go through a big upgrade in about 5 years' time that will actually allow it to run in what we call high luminosity LHC mode for another decade or so after that. So the plan is that after this upgrade, we'll actually be able to record many, many more collisions in a given period of time. And by having these much larger data sets, it means that we'll actually have a chance to look for either new particles or new effects in our indirect measurements that are even rarer than the ones we've been able to look at now. So the LHC itself still has quite a long way to go. But because it takes so long to plan and then build these enormous collider experiments, there's actually planning already underway to discuss what we should build after the LHC. It was mentioned early on in the session that in 2012, the Atlas and CMS collaborations announced that they discovered the Higgs boson, which is a very important particle in the standard model. It was the last missing piece for us to detect experimentally. But one thing that people are thinking about when deciding what we're going to build next is actually if we need a new machine that would enable us to make really precise measurements of the Higgs boson. But there's already discussions ongoing about what form that collider should take. And even beyond that, should we actually be pushing the frontiers and going to an enormous 100 TeV collider? So that's 10 times or so the energy of the LHC. But I can see, Michelle, I think Mikhail wants to add something to that. Or Floris, which one?
Yeah. Just to add that actually, I think 5 to 10 years on the timescales that we plan all these experiments is not that long. And we are already at CERN, but then also in all the universities, really trying to prepare for the future upgrades in terms of the technologies that we can choose and use. And we're doing test beams, for example. So we have small beams that come from the as one of the stages to gradually accelerate particles. And we can also use these streams to create create proton beams, which are slightly lower in energy, but very useful to test the technologies that we want to use in 5 to 10 years time. And for example, Michele has something that he's testing there or intending to test there at the moment.
Yes, we are, as you said, we are always trying to improve our theories and models, but as Floris just said, the detectors, the experiments have to go with that. So we have to always plan a long time ahead. And one of the test beams we are performing, hopefully in a couple of months' time, is to test, for example, a new way of identifying particles with a new nanomaterial. And that would, for example, drastically change the way we can build particle identification detectors in the future. And that meets really the timescale, 10, 15 years plus in the future. And that's how far we have to think ahead and plan these things. And they all start with these small steps now. And then meets hardware and also software studies that we are performing here.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Now we're just about at the end. So just as one final question, if say a teenager's watching this and they're very interested in high-energy physics, they're fascinated by the wonderful video put together for us and like what we heard today, is there any way they can get involved in it now? And can you give them any sort of recommendations of what sort of path they can take to best set themselves up to work at places like CERN in the future?
I mean, maybe a good way to do this is to ask the younger people again what they what path they took to get into particle physics.
I'm happy to say something about that. So when I'm just thinking, you know, when I was 15, what was I doing? I guess I was working hard in my maths and physics lessons. Don't neglect maths if you're interested in physics, because it's really important, especially when you get to university level. It's it really uses a lot of the math skills that you'll have developed in GCSE and A level. But on top of that, just kind of be interested in things. Ask lots of questions about the physics you're learning about. Ask your teacher questions. If you don't understand things, you know, ask people about it, and to make sure you want to just keep learning and properly understanding the stuff on your syllabus, and maybe even beyond it. If you're really interested, maybe you'll want to do some sort of wider reading. I remember when I was at school, there was a few pop science books I read. There's some good ones by Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw. I think my favorite was called Why Does E Equals MC Squared. But if you go to any bookshop and find the pop science section, you can have a flick through. There's plenty of books about all sorts of interesting things like quantum mechanics and special relativity that are kind of written to be accessible to people at your sort of level. That was my approach anyway.
Okay, and Michele, I think you want to say something?
Yeah, I don't know how applicable it is for the students in the UK, since I'm from Germany, but I think that a couple of steps that Ben already mentioned are quite useful. But what attracts me and I think many of my colleagues about physics is that it's really an international field. You can work really anywhere in the world on super interesting experiments, and you never stop learning. And it's that what Ben mentions, that ongoing curiosity about things, that really inspires you to always continue with what you're doing. And there are tons of interesting programs like the one at CERN. There's a summer school, but there are many summer schools in the world. And I think, of course, at some point you have to start studying physics if you want to be in physics. That's somewhat clear. But then there are so many paths you can go, right? It's virtually at least limitless. And I don't know if Lois, you want to have something about that.
Yeah, to add to that, I think also a really nice aspect of physics, and especially experimental physics, is the hands-on aspect, and that's something that it also can really be motivating and stimulating to see actually what what's going on. And there are several outreach projects like this. And the one I got involved with when I was a high school student is a project called HiSpark. And there's also a UK, that was in the Netherlands. And there's a UK version, which is called Crocs. And here there's we were using an array of particle detectors, each on the top rooftop of the school, to measure, well, you can guess, cosmic rays. Really motivated me. And there you can, of course, by having such a big array on different school rooftops, you can measure the size of the shower from the primary particle. And that gives you a lot of information about its energy. So we were really studying things that real important physics, especially because the energy of these particles can be so high that we cannot measure it any other way. So yeah, it was really nice to see the hands-on aspect.
Excellent. Yeah, well, that's wonderful. Nice to know that these sort of programs are around, and you can end up doing actual physics with physicists, even if you're not quite graduated yet. Right then, we've gone over a little bit. Hopefully our viewers won't mind too much. I found it fascinating. If you haven't had a chance already, please...
Just put in, I mean...
Oh, sorry.
Just to add something to that, I mean, we would talk about physics a lot, but at CERN, for example, CERN doesn't rely on just physicists. It's a major enterprise which actually involves all sorts of science, technology, and engineering. It involves mechanical engineers, structural engineers. It involves chemical engineers, it involves electronic engineers, software engineers. So the field of particle physics is actually much, much wider than just physics. I think that's quite an important message to get across. It's, there are lots of opportunities which are not just physics in these disciplines.
Lovely. Well, that's excellent to hear as well. Thank you. Right then, so just to wrap it up, if you've got any feedback, if you could please submit that through our Physics at Work feedback page. There's links to it from the Physics at Work homepage. That's very important to us and how we structure these events in the future, you know, improvements we need to make, if you let us know, that sort of thing. Or if you just really enjoyed it, that's always nice to hear as well, then please let us know. And I shall let our no doubt very busy physicists get back to their important work and say goodbye to you all now. So thank you very much, and hopefully see you in the future.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay then.